Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday here on Mind Talk. Thoughtful Thursday is the day that we talk to experts about things that we really want you to give some significant thought to. And certainly today is an excellent candidate for that as we talk about our emotional footprints. Allow me to introduce you to Dr. Saul Levine, who is a psychiatrist. He has written 5 other books. He was educated at McGill and Stanford Universities, and he was a professor at the University of Toronto. Dr. Levine, you have been a busy individual throughout your career. Thank you for taking time to speak to us today on Mind Talk.
No, it's my pleasure. It's great to be here.
Now, Dr. Levine, you taught... Levine. Dr. Levine, you have created a document, a dialogue, if you will, for the reader to sort of engage in the lives of people you describe as being ordinary, but indeed having extraordinary lives. And I'd kind of like to start off with your own life, because for those listening, I mean, they've certainly heard that you are quite accomplished educationally and professionally. And yet you describe your dad as having grown up with his parents, 9 brothers and sisters, in a 1-room clapboard-walled house with a grass-thatched roof and a single pot-bellied stove for heat. That doesn't sound like you came from particularly auspicious beginnings.
And I'm glad you started with that. My father is a kind of hero of this book and my life, but and my late dad. But you're right; he was brought up in those circumstances. That home was actually, if we can call it a home, was in a little town that used to be called a shtetl. It was the town in Fiddler on the Roof, in Lithuania, and. That pot-bellied stove barely heated the 1 room in the dead of winter, and there were pogroms and anti-Semitic demonstrations, and then the Nazis came, so it was not a pretty picture. They escaped one by one over the years to the New World, and I was brought in an inner city, brought up in an inner city with a lot of other immigrant kids, mainly Jewish, but not all, and my father had to, quote, make the furnace every morning. I recall him doing that. Have to shovel coal into a heater. That was our central heating system. Without that, we'd freeze. In Montreal at that time, where the winters were brutal. I never felt that I lost out on anything. My father was a gentle, sweet, giving man. My mother was a voracious reader, both on their own, so to speak, brilliant on their own. And I grew up with a group of boys and girls that I'm in my 70s, friendly with today. They're all over the United States and actually Europe. And we're still in touch, especially through the blessings of the Internet. It's not always a blessing, but in this case, it's a major blessing. Yeah, so anyway, those were my beginnings, humble they were. But I had food. I had the loving family. I had clothing. And that's all we needed. No luxuries whatsoever. No pets. No nothing. I mean, just, and nobody wanted. Nobody felt we deserved because we didn't know any better. And I was lucky enough to do well in school and went on to McGill, and then, as you mentioned, Stanford, and the rest. And I've had a checkered life in the sense that I've had setbacks and successes, and like everybody, absolutely. Everybody, and I don't know you, Pamela. It's a pleasure to meet you. But I would bet, without knowing you, because it's been my hobby all my life, as soon as you scratch the surface, you find drama.
That's right.
You find successes and setbacks. You find loves and losses. You find disappointments, and you find ecstasies. And that is what life is. One last thing I'll say about my quote, humble beginnings, and I'm not sorry for that. Believe me, I feel enriched, is that I had this misguided, I would say, view as an adolescent that life would be just a single straight line upward, bigger, better, faster a trajectory. And of course, you know that old adage, man plans and God laughs, there's no such thing. Nobody's life is that kind of straight line trajectory to success. And if it is, actually, it's ill-founded. It's disappointing because we realize at the end, if that's all it is, I'm faster and I'm richer, I'm not better, I'm not happier. And so that's what I've learned over the course of years working with hundreds of patients and doing a lot of studies on young people and elderly who've learned what life is really all about. That's what this book is. So I'm glad we started with the fact that people vary across the socioeconomically and emotionally and ethnically and racially, but I'll tell you, I've never found a person, never, and I mean, I speak a lot to strangers, even in subway cars and things like that, who hasn't had amazing experiences in their lives. Destitution, pain, success, wealth, love, loss, all those things. So I'm prattling on, but that's what it's all about.
Well, you know, the prattle is actually quite interesting. So I thank you for that. You know, what struck me, I mean, there are many things that struck me about this document, if you will, this our emotional footprint is, as you say, the many things that we have in common, and yet the very many things that we have that make us all unique, and that no one is quote unquote ordinary. And you know, right. I think in these days and times, there seems to be such a significant divide, with people very often seeing themselves as either extraordinary or ordinary, and nothing in between, and that there are no similarities. And your book sort of brings home, just through the telling of the stories of various people's lives, the fact that there is unique, there is ordinary, and there is extraordinary, and it's kind of all in the same person. It can be all in the same life.
Very well put. Very well put. I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump. He's one of the few people I know who thinks, at least that's what he says to the world, I am extraordinary. I know very few people who feel that way, actually. I know a lot of successful people in politics and the arts and the sciences who have done extraordinary work to the other person, in the eye of the beholder. But none of them would say, as he does, I am the best. I am. So that's kind of a bit of buffoonery, but for him it works. And what you just said, we all are all of the above. We are all ordinary. We are all extraordinary. We are all, in some ways, less than. And it's a jumble. It is. And at times, we are all of them. At other times, we go highs and lows. And that is life. That is the richness, actually. That is what I call the tapestry, the colorful tapestry of life.
And indeed, as we go through our emotional footprint, you've brought to life really 10 people. Well, you know what? Let me ask you to describe how you approached writing our emotional footprint, how you approached the stories and the scenario for this book.
Okay. Thank you for asking that. I didn't want to write about celebrities. I didn't want to write about people who have made it to the top and big and they're, you know, world beaters, et cetera, because that doesn't mean anything to people, because it's for kind of fan magazines. I wanted to write a book about everyone I've met, all these people I talk about in ordinary walks of life. And I picked 10 people at random, not patients, not psychiatric patients. They might have had a psychiatrist or a psychologist or something with them at some point in their lives, but that's not why they're chosen. They're chosen because they are so-called ordinary, but of course they're not ordinary at all. These 10 people, I put them in a literary technique, Oh, it's terrible to get old. Don't get old, folks.
Okay. now that we've resolved
conceit,
that issue.
It's a literary conceit. That was the word I was thinking.
Okay.
It's where I put these 10 people. And by the way, they are real people. They're unrecognized because I've added, padded, and erased, et cetera, stories. So they are. But I know exactly who they are. And some of them know that they're there too. And I put them all in an Amtrak rail car as strangers. And they put the reader, like you and me, in the car, and we see them coming in, and we size them up by the way they look, by the way they talk, by the way they dress, the way they sound, and we draw conclusions. And then I go into the stories of these 10 people, ordinary people. And each story tells us a lot about life. Each story is at times degrading, at other times exciting and wonderful, full of love, full of disappointment, failure, and success. And I then, after, well, during each story, I write commentaries about what they're going through, but I try not to interfere with the story because the story speaks for itself. And at the end, we evaluate their lives. What kind of person were they? What did they contribute to themselves, to their family, to the world? I use a number of devices. Can I go on with this?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the devices I use are three main major categories. One is I use 4 B's, which I found in my research with very young people and older people. How they evaluate lives. What kind of a person were they? How did they feel? Were they grounded? Did they like themselves? Did they appreciate themselves? Or were they always down on themselves or high on themselves? Which group did they, then belonging, who did they feel an integral part of? Family, friends, religion, group, colleagues, alone? And then believing. Well, If life is only accumulation of material goods and toys, then it's very empty. So is there anything they believed in? It could be a deity, it could be God, it could be a religion, but it could be also a system of values, humanism, a system of universal caring for other people, but some ethical principles and value system to live by. So it's not just the rat race of everyday life and the bills, and the material goods, and the responsibilities and obligations, etc. And finally, which is attached to one other thing, is benevolence. So it's being, belonging, believing, benevolence. What have I done for other people? What mark did I leave on other people? Not did I pay them, not did I give them gifts, but what kind of emotional gifts did I give them? I'll get that in a second. The second major category is resilience. How easily or how graciously and gracefully did they come back from setbacks? When they were, in some ways, I measure not only how people are achievers or succeeders, so to speak, but how they do that in a way, in the same way, gracefully as when they're losers and suffer. That is to say, do they come back with their head high, and have they learned something, and have they tried to make amends for having fallen back or hurt people? The same way, when they are at the top of their game, do they develop a kind of egotistical arrogance? I am better. It both have to be done with a kind of grace. And what kind of people were these 10? What kind of people, I ask the reader, have you been? And finally, related to benevolence and all these things, is our emotional footprint. In this day and age, the Paris talks just ended a few days ago, hopefully with some progress, but I talk about our emotional footprint as opposed to our carbon footprint, and nobody talks about that.
Right.
And our emotional footprint is how we affect others throughout the course of our lives, not only in our families, not only in our classrooms, not only at work, on the streets, in the shops. I've seen, and I'm sure you have, Pamela, and all our listeners, people who are rude, uncivil, demeaning to others publicly. And privately, and I have so many incidents that are, but it's not unique to me. Everybody sees this. And then we hear this also in the airwaves. We read trolling on the internet, which is god-awful to me. People let their nastier sides come out sometimes. And if we're moving in that direction, I say, God help us. I really feel that we as a world have to pay attention to how we affect others. And when we die, when we pass on, how we have affected others in the past, has it been a positive emotional footprint? Did we leave an indelible ripple effect on society by being nice people, respectful people, tolerant people, caring, compassionate, all those things? Or have we been rude, arrogant, demeaning, nasty, threatening, aggressive, etc.?
And
that's our I'm sorry.
No, please continue.
Well, I just want that is the nature of our emotional footprint. And I talk about that when it's all said and done. What is our emotional footprint in terms of positivity, And the same thing with carbon. We are so, and I think rightfully so, we should be thinking about carbon footprint and to reduce our carbon footprint. This isn't reducing or increasing, it's positive or negative.
You know, one of the things that I particularly appreciated about the book, Our Emotional Footprint, is, you know, the fact that you use stories to give people information, which is really what Mind Talk actually does most of the time, is to tell stories to give people information. So it wasn't about preaching or telling people what's right or what's wrong. It was about sharing the lives of others. It is about sharing the lives of others, sort of giving the reader a peek inside of somebody else's world. But again, in a way that is respectful and curious, which curiosity is sort of one of my favorite words. Yeah. When you talk about the four universal core concerns central to adults of all ages, and again, I'll just restate them as you already have: being, belonging, believing, and benevolence. I wonder how that shows up in your view, and even what we're looking at in the political world today, in the sort of international world today. It seems like certainly benevolence doesn't seem to show up very often.
I could not. You're a woman of my own heart. We've just met, but you are. I could not agree more. I find anything but benevolence. People going at each other hammer and tongs. Some, aside from buffoonery, there are nasty things being said about each other. Benevolence is the last thing on their mind. They might say at some point, oh, he's a nice guy, or she's a nice woman, but it really has nothing to do with that. It has to do with putting yourself forward and putting the other person down. That's, in a sense, that's what competition is all about. And if that's the case, is this all that we're all about? Is this all about winning competition, power, control? I'm the best and you're the weakest. If that's all it is, it's fairly terrible. So what do the young people learn from what their elders now? Well, their elders are fighting in about 10 different, a little more, at least 10 battlegrounds around the world. Our elders are utilizing guns to shoot up various people or areas. Our elders are not happy. Our elders are critical of others, sometimes racist, sometimes demeaning, sometimes nasty. This is what the kids are being brought up with, and maybe we can correct some of that within the home and within the school. I hope we can, but I fear for that. Benevolence, just not our emotional footprint, using my words, and benevolence is not even on the radar screen. It is. If somebody spoke, talked this way, I just recalled something from my youth. I'll mention it. I remembered the father of the present Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Elliott Trudeau. Now it's Justin Trudeau. Made some kind of comment where people were clamoring about, butter and bread. What did he call it? Butter and, well, food on the table and things like that, very rightly so. But he said something about, we have to think also about caring for each other. And he was ridiculed. Now, we're talking about 40 years ago or more. He was ridiculed. He was criticized. How dare you even talk about things like that? Well, I think we should be talking about things like that. I think that there is such rancor and disrespect in the airwaves. And I know, you know, I sometimes look at, well, I write a blog now, but I've seen this so often over the last few years when blogs have been out there. Somebody says something that might be warm and respectful or caring or whatever, but then somebody disagrees, and the disagreement, the level and the intensity of disagreement is so out of proportion and so nasty, and sometimes with cuss words and sometimes with insults and sometimes just putting people on, the trolling is what it's called nowadays.
Yeah, it can be pretty remarkable.
It's beyond remarkable. People take, it tells me, it's something we have to learn, and when we're talking about our emotional footprint and benevolence, as you brought up, is that we all have dark sides. And if we're appealing to only or largely the dark sides of our nature, and that goes for the political electorate or the people listening to the news or listening to almost anything, if that's what it's all about in these kind of arenas, then we are moving towards a very, I think, unhappy, unpleasant, and dangerous place to live in. So I know I don't want to sound preachy. I want the stories to speak for themselves because, and you're right, I like stories like you do, and I think they're important. But I want people to see themselves in these stories. You know, that could be me on that train. And I tell you, I took these 10 people at random with using some add-ons from other people's lives to hide their real identities. But I could choose almost anybody. Almost anybody. Because I know, I'm not holding myself up as an example at all, but people I've met of all ages, and I start asking them questions, and they start answering, and we have mutual bonding and trust, and they open up to things that have happened. And I think every time I think I've heard it all, I haven't.
then you hear one more thing.
I have one more thing. You, I want to say, you what?
Folks, we're going to take a break.
Okay.
And we will be right back and continue our conversation with Dr. Saul Levine, author of Our Emotional Footprint. And Dr. Levine, when we come back, I'd like for you to introduce us to Patricia.
Oh, okay. Be glad to.
Folks, we will return in just a moment. Dr. Levine, you introduced us to, in the book, a woman named Patricia. And so I'd like for you to just share her story with the audience. Who was she? What was her life like?
You know, it's interesting that you said that. I could pick any one of the 10, honestly, and Pamela, and think, what's a great example of somebody who's had an interesting life. But you said Patricia, and I immediately ran to it, and I've written the book, and I know these people well. then honestly, I just picked up the book in front of me, and I said, wait a second, which one is Patricia? There were a number of women, and of course, they're pseudonyms. They're not their real names. So I reminded myself, what did I call this person this time? Patricia's a very interesting woman, and she's still alive. She lives in an urban setting. She's now almost just about 70, I think, late 60s. And I know her story extremely well from many different perspectives. No, she was not a patient of mine. She was born in a very unusual background in which her mother took off to be an actress and abandoned the family at a very early age. Because she was a frustrated thespian actress and took off to go to the continent. She had always had these pretensions. And her father was a steward on a passenger liner. We're talking now during the 40s, I guess, and 50s, and was never home. And when mother took off suddenly with a kind of a perfunctory farewell note in the morning, it was a really sad kind of situation. He would fob her off on people using the Catholic Church as a place to keep her after school and stuff like that, so she wasn't alone. And that was one part about her. The other part about her was that she became self-sufficient. Another was that she was a very heavy girl, so kids bullied her and made fun of her. And this, as a young girl, that continued throughout her entire life. And the father one day said that, you know, I can't manage this any longer. I want you to go live with your grandmother, whom she didn't even know. Her grandmother didn't want her in another town, but the father gave her some money. And that's the last time she saw her father. He disappeared, and then he died on board a couple of years later, and that was the end of it. And she said at the time, poof, it's gone. And so she's there with her grandmother, and her grandmother raised her during her adolescence and was not happy to see her.
Well, and grandmother really seemed like an acquired taste at the very least.
An acquired taste is right. She did this on a mercenary basis and gave her some more money to live with. And did not want, and had all kind of rules, and also they both were used to go to church together, and but they became kind of friendly. In addition to being grandmother and mother, and granddaughter estranged from each other, they suddenly became friends. And not suddenly, you know, gradually over a while. And they used to laugh, and we're talking as she gets older and older, and they used to play piano together, and they used to go to church together, and they used to listen to music together, which they both loved, and go, as I said, go to church. And talk about how lonely they both were, that the grandmother had an affair once and essentially gave birth to Patricia's mother. And Patricia... she was rejected by males and by females, and always felt bullied and estranged from the world. And they used to laugh, and they would drink together in the evening and make fun of each other. And there was something buoyant and lovely about it. Then Patricia went off to a local Catholic university, but they saw each other a lot, and the grandmother fell in love with somebody at the advanced age. She was in her 60s at the time, and Patricia was full of love for her grandmother and happiness, but jealous, and jealous to such an extent that she, will I ever have someone to love me?
And, you know, one of the things that was striking about Patricia's story is the significant losses that she experienced almost one right after the other. Her mother
Absolutely.
Goes, her father sends her away, then her father dies, her grandmother is her grandmother, then her grandmother has a boyfriend, she's off. You know, it's just, it's the kind of sort of string of losses that from the outside looking in, one would imagine that Patricia would sort of fall apart and fall into some hole.
She went, there were setbacks, and she cried, and she lost sleep, and she thought, will it ever change? But she, back to the word resilience, and that happened. People have setbacks in their lives, even from terrible destitution. She did have these losses, and she also had lack of fulfillment socially, except for her grandmother, and then she, in a sense, lost her because her grandmother was truly, madly, deeply in love with somebody else. So kind of fast forward, she finishes undergraduate school, college, and does fairly well, and didn't know what to do, and she got some kind of scholarship through the church to go to Rome for a year. It started as a vacation, and she got very caught up in the church, as she had been before, but this in a very meaningful manner. She went to the Vatican. She went to, from Rome, she went to other parts of Italy, to various kinds of churches and dioceses, and met with the priests, etc. And she really wanted to become a priest. She thought this would be wonderful. She even spoke to some people about the nuns and sisters and others, but was whenever she brought up the desire to be one of the leaders of the church, they, of course, frowned on it at that time. They remember we're talking about many years ago.
Right. That was not the thing that women did.
No. And even now,
with
a very liberal pontiff, women are still held back and from the kind of major positions in the church of leadership. Not she wasn't looking for administrative leaders. She liked the spiritual part of it. So she did that for a year and became a little bit disillusioned with it. She'll never be able to go break that glass ceiling. She decided she's going to go into law school. This had something to do with the man who her grandmother had fallen in love with and eventually married, who was a lawyer. And she went to law school, had bullying there and setbacks there, rejection there too, But things started to change. For one thing, she became an excellent student. For another, she really loved the law, made a couple of close friends, males and females, still nothing romantic, and did exceedingly well, especially in the area of labor law, where she made her mark. And she went on a kind of trajectory then, propelled by jet propulsion. She did exceedingly well and had a major role in the Department of Labor in a local, Department of Labor in the local area and in the state and then federally. So she made her mark. She never lost track of wanting to be somebody in the church. Always went devout every Sunday. In one of her labor negotiations, she meets this guy who's a very obnoxious lawyer from New York who belittles his opponents, and these were labor negotiations, and she put him down publicly. And he was set back on his heels, or really on his butt. but afterwards, he invited her out to discuss it, because nobody's ever done that thing. He's very successful and prominent, and who would treat him like that? But he was taken with her, and he said, you know, I'd like to see you sometime. Clearly, for the first time in her life, by this time she's in her mid to late 30s, he's coming on to her. Somebody is coming on to me, she felt. To me. How is that possible?
In her 30s.
Yeah. I didn't mention that when she tried to get jobs before this labor department job. People would say, come up, you sound good, and they'd take a look at her, this very heavy woman, and then suddenly they'd close their eye over full or give some other cock and bull story. But she finally made it in the department. I left that out. And it's important because this guy was a bit shorter than she and a bit, not frail, but slimmer. But he wanted to see her, and he wanted to see her romantically, involving sex, but he was married with kids in another city, and he started coming through her city, meeting with her regularly, and they would have their own romps in the hay, so to speak.
That's a lovely way to put it.
and I remember when she was talking about how the first time he was going to visit, she was like a 13, 14, 15-year-old girl, worried about what he'd say, what to say to him, how to dress, how to look. And she had no one to confide in, no one to ask about what I should do. And she was scared out of her wits. And he was a bit nervous, too, for all his talk. But they, quote, went at it. And this carried on for years in the sense that it was not going to be a permanent relationship. And this was while she was very much involved with the church.
That's interesting.
And she did not go to her own bishop, whom she was very close to, went to confession a few times outside of her diocese, and told this story more or less to the priests there. And a couple of them had her do Hail Marys and rosaries, but one or two were actually somewhat permissive. You know, Patricia, you know, you're doing a lot in your life, and this is just part of it, and put it into some kind of spiritual rationale. I know if anybody hearing this from the church are going to be annoyed at me, but I'm just a messenger here.
I was going to say, that's not the Catholic priest that I would think of who would say, yeah, this is kind of okay. But that's what she experienced.
So fast forward to where she is now. She broke up with this fellow because she just needed more. And it happened on a dime. It happened very quickly. She just said, I'm not getting satisfaction. I don't go anywhere with him. We don't travel. It's not that I want marriage, but but also sexually, that they had their fill for quite a few years. She had enough of him. She just lost interest, just like that. And he was heartbroken. It was so strange. This guy was married with three kids, by this time grown and in college. He didn't want to give her up, and it wasn't the rolls in the hay. He was in love. It's the strangest thing about this whole thing, because he never once enunciated that to her. He never once said, I love you. He would bring her little tchotchkes, gifts, things like that, but never in terms of this is a romantic, bring flowers and woo her. So she was okay with that, but he tried for quite a while to get back, but she just wouldn't. The other thing that happened is that she became an activist in the church, which she is now. And with this latest pope, she is suddenly feeling opportunities opening for her. So she's part of a group of very activists. She joined Activist Women in the United States, and she's on a major committee now that travels to the Vatican. And there are meetings going on. It's behind the scenes, and they're not always the sisters in the various orders across the world are not always happy with these women because they think they are, in fact, infidels. And she was told that once by a male, but not people at the Vatican anymore. They're giving their time in court, so to speak. They are. So right now she is a successful labor lawyer. She's in her late 60s. She's going to retire very soon. She's very active, has friends. Music is still her passion. The church is still her passion. But she's become an activist, and she has a very meaningful, happy life. Is she still very heavy? Yes. Let me just say she's about 5'9" and in the upper 200s in pounds.
Okay.
So it's not a question of defining somebody as overweight. She knows she's overweight. She knows, this has been since her childhood, but it's part and parcel of her. When she walked on the train, and I describe it, you see this very elegant woman with a large cross in the middle of her chest, her bosom, but very well put together. Yes, she is large, but she's larger than life. And she has been an extraordinary, as you put it in terms of her losses, resilient soul. She's been very, and through the church, she's worked in various kinds of deprived areas in her city, giving to less fortunate indigent people. She feels like a member of the church. She has close friends, people who care for her more. She's cared for now more by others than she ever was in her family. It's quite remarkable.
Interesting.
And yes, it is. And not only that, she's able to reciprocate and be a very caring for her. She's very benevolent. So the sum, I think, is a very resilient person who inhabits the four B's and is who has a very positive emotional footprint. And it's not that she's always happy. It's not that she's collected a lot of toys. It's not that she never gets angry. But the general gestalt of this person is a positive imprint on this world, her positive emotional footprint. Mainly, though, Pamela, is she's fascinating. Now, people would see her, okay, she's a gray, heavy woman involved with the church. What is the big story here? It's a very dramatic story.
It absolutely is.
She's an ordinary
is.
Person, but yeah. She's extraordinary. So I feel blessed to have met her and spoken to her about her life. And but that goes for every one of the passengers. They're all they're different races, different ages, different genders. But I could say that about all of them. The cover by the book, of the book, by the way, Pamela, I don't know if you saw that. It's a very interesting cover. It's actually a painting in my home.
Ah, it does look like a painting. It looks like an oil, is it?
It is oil. Hmm. It is an original oil painting in my dining area, actually. It's a beautiful. It's so moving. It's about a man at the crossroads, and you see a literal crossroads. But the reason I bring it up is that it was painted by, what did I call him in the book? his real name is John, but in the book I call him, I'm sorry, this is Neville. Neville da Costa. And so he's one of the characters in the book, and he painted that painting, and then he passed away because of cancer. So he has been, they're all interesting. They're also all, to me, inspiring.
They really are. We're going to take a break in a second, but, one of the things that strikes me, certainly about Patricia's story and all of the stories, is as you go through these extraordinary, ordinary lives, and they experience so much of what so many people experience, and yet they are truly having a positive emotional footprint that unlike a footprint on the beach that washes away very quickly, their footprints are long-lasting just by the nature of who they are. These are really amazing stories and wonderful, and they're hopeful stories and wonderful people. Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with our emotional footprint, ordinary people and their extraordinary lives with Dr. Saul Levine. We'll be right back. Dr. Levine, one of the things that strikes me throughout the stories, as you share the lives of these members on the train, is that they each experience things that many people would say, as a result of those things, that their future is forever written by the cement, if you will, of their past, that there is no way to change, there is no way to thrive and survive. Certainly with Patricia, she had tons of losses on all kinds of levels, some of which we haven't even talked about, but she was able to survive and is able to survive and thrive. I'd like to turn to the story of Ken, because Ken is someone who experienced, as you describe, child abuse, and many people who have experienced child abuse have the sense, not only the people who've experienced it, but the people who know them, they'll have the sense that they are forever scarred and can never go on to lead happy lives, that their abusers, in effect, have power over them forever. And that is not true, and that becomes very clear in the case of Ken, who actually was abused in more than one way by more than one person. Talk about Ken for a few moments, if you would.
No, I'd absolutely be glad to talk about Ken. I do want to say one thing you mentioned just before you, so I don't forget, just before you went to break. You mentioned the word. You mentioned the concept that sometimes footprints in the sand wash away. You know, I'm a little bit embarrassed to say I never thought about that. Maybe I would have changed the title. I don't know. I like the title, but I'm. You're right. I don't want them to wash away. I want our positive emotional footprint to be lasting in the sense that it contributes to the world. So I just wanted to say that Ken is a very interesting young man. He, like me, was a child of, it was the first generation immigrants. He was Jewish, he's about my age, actually. And he was brought up in a home that was impoverished, in a slum, a tenement, brought up with other immigrant families that had no money. And immigration is now on the mind of so many people.
Yes.
That, when you see what he's done with his life, you think twice about rejecting them. In any event, his house was a demeaning place in the sense that his mother and father was kind of absent. He was a hard worker, very participatory in what was going on at home. He'd come home and look at art books. He was educated in a yeshiva in Europe, but here he was impoverished, where he worked in a machine shop. His mother was home all day and was, as the Jewish would call, a yenta, talkative, loud, opinionated, storytelling, tattling, you know, all those things, gossip. She was also very nasty to Kenny. She put him down. She demeaned him. She criticized him. He was never good enough. Well, he went to a local school with a bunch of kids, all of them first generation, all very bright and all accomplished academicians now, or doctors or lawyers or whatever they became, and he just didn't have the smart, so to speak, at that time to do well in school wherever he turned. And then it was just in the early World War II years, a cousin from Europe came to live with them, an older cousin, and they took him in, and he had to share a bedroom with Kenny. And it was imposed upon him. Kenny wasn't happy about it. The older kid wasn't happy about it. But also what was happening at this time, an unhappy home, not doing well at school, rejected by his family, this older young man started molesting Kenny each night. They'd come in, and this boy also, this outsider, became a favorite of the mother, for some reason, but she still disliked her own son. This was relentless, and this went on for years, and it was painful, it was punitive, it was frightening. Kenny said he couldn't tell anybody in his family because nobody would believe him, would blame him. How could you say this? He just knew, and he was right. That was the nature of his mother, and I've forgotten, did he have a sister or not? I don't remember. In any event, I have to look in the book. I think it was not until he turned 13 in a bar mitzvah that he threatened his older cousin with a knife. And if he ever did that again, he'd stab him because he was coming into his own. And so that ended it. But this was, I would say, at least 6 or 7 years of nightly brutality. I can't anything other than this guy was not subtle. He was strong. He would grab him. He would do whatever he wanted with him. And I won't have to be blatant about what exactly he did, but anything you can imagine to him. And he demanded it. And he said that he also threatened that if you tell your parents, I'm going to do something to hurt you for sure, but I'll hurt them too.
Which is what abusers do. Unfortunately, I mean, that's part of the power that they wield.
That was the power, and there was no reporting. And even actually in those days, we're talking about the 40s, early 50s, in those days, to report meant nothing because nobody would believe it.
Yeah.
Nobody would take it seriously. So what if he did? A big deal. Suck it up. In any event, the one thing that Kenny did have was a talent. It wasn't so much a talent of singing or acting or a particular skill that one could say, but he did it all. He was the consummate performer. He got a job as a theater usher. He got a job as a radio station. And he got a scholarship, actually, to a community college where he studied drama. And he shone. He shone in whatever he did. When he got up on stage, and I heard the stories from people who knew him. It was in a seventh grade play that he got up on stage and wowed the audience. Again, not with his voice or his acting technique, but just his projection. And he always had that. And he felt like a loser among his friends, but his friends always, not envied, but they appreciated his two things. They appreciated the fact that he was so talented in that respect, but also that he was so open about being miserable at home. They weren't open. Boys tend to be kind of closed behind outside, you know, be a man, suck it up, etc. In any event, he got a scholarship from the community college to New York in a conservatory, a dramatic conservatory, and he did extremely well there, too. And I have to say that his parents didn't come to his college graduation. His parents didn't wish him well. His parents thought he was a loser from being, especially the mom. Father seemed to be a non-entity, actually.
It's just dreadful.
Yeah, dreadful.
But happens. Really happens to a lot of people.
And it happened to this young man. And in New York, he was kind of a favorite of other kids. He felt he found his métier, he's found his forte, he's found his home, sort of the first home he's ever had, where I belong. He lived in a small room, and he started going, hanging out with the kids and hanging out with the profs. There were two professors took a liking to him, a shine to him, and proposed all kinds of suggestions of working with him and telling him to change his name from Kenny to Ken, and he'd be a star. They were actually wooing him. They were a gay couple, but they were nefarious. And I don't want to say gays are nefarious at all. They could have been a heterosexual couple. But in this particular case, these two men whom he idolized because they were professors in his department that he loved, they would go out to drinks. And finally, they, quote, propositioned him. And they said, why don't you come live with us? And he wasn't getting the point. Living with them would sound like a good idea, but why are they being so nice to me? And finally, they spilled the beans. He would become part of their ménage à trois, their lovemaking. Scared the hell out of him, reminded him of his cousin.
Of course.
Of other abuses. All the abuses came back. He ran away. He was in tears and he was vomiting. He was sick to his stomach. He saw his career going. He saw his life going down the drain. My mother was right. I am a loser. I can't go on any longer. He thought of ending it all, but he didn't. He remembered there had been a student who from that conservatory who went back to Los Angeles, and he phoned her, and in tears, and she said, come out here, I'll help you get started here. She had, her father was an accountant who worked in the show business and helped him get on his feet. I'm going fast forwarding, missing a lot of the,
yes,
the meat of the story. I'm giving the skeleton. But when he gets to California, he finally finds a new home, but he's much untrustful of himself, of his own judgment. Is the same thing going to happen? I was miserable. I got abused. I finally moved away. I got miserable, and I get again a kind of abuse. Not, they didn't let it go all the way, but it was abuse.
Right.
And now I come here. Is it going to happen to me again? Am I still this loser? And he starts again winning people over with his skills and his joy up on stage, because there, his fantasy life was what saved him right through childhood, right through adolescence, and into his young adulthood. In the meantime, he feels he's a loser romantically. What girl is going to be interested in him? And maybe after all this abuse, he really is gay. They see something in him that he didn't know, but he doesn't feel it. And the girl who befriended him and her family was getting antsy about maybe he is gay, or maybe he's not interested in me, or maybe he's wasting my time, or he's playing with me. A Lothario, really, in disguise. And they finally have this very touching evening where he breaks down and cries and talks to her and for hours and hours. And they end up making love the next day, and they marry. And they have three kids. And life gets much better. The first real home.
And then she dies at some point.
And then she dies of cancer. And he's lost. And his kids by this time are off. And one is in Africa. And two are in different cities, one in academic, one in the advertising industry, and or literary industry, publishing. And he goes into the depths of despair. And this time no longer questioning whether he's a loser, because he feels, I have contributed, I have a good family, but she was the love of my life, and I don't want to live without her. And after a couple of years where he sees therapist and he gets on medication and works through it, and his kids are trying to be as supportive as possible, he meets another woman. In this case, a Latina woman who is from Mexico and who has a large Latina family, and who the family started off as illegal immigrants. Here we're back again to that story. And all these stories are, you know, they're written with commentaries of mine throughout,
yes,
to bring it up to date. But that's where he is now. He's now in his 70s, living with this woman, a life that is not trying to make it farther than 180 degrees from where he started. But that's what it is. He's in a happy place. He has her stepchildren. She was a widow. He's been adopted by the Latina community, so to speak, in which the family. He's still very close to his own kids who are living abroad or whatever they're doing. One of them is gay and living in Africa. The other two are married. He feels now he's never at the top of his game in terms of I am extraordinary. He would never. He's always humble, always saying I don't deserve. But he says I have to pinch myself. That I am in this situation now, in a loving home, with loving people, with children, a beloved passed away wife, and I accomplished all of this. I'm not a superstar. I've been a director, a producer, an actor, but I have very little money. But I've never been so full of love for other people and for myself. So that's a story of Kenny, a very winning story. He's a very, I know him very well. He's a very impressive man.
And, you know, one of the things that you say as we begin to wrap up our time together today, which I think is so poignant and so true and so powerful for folks who have had any number of childhood challenges, such as Kenny, such as Patricia, you say despair can give way to joy. And I think that's
right.
Really... if there's one sentence that I think is so powerful throughout our emotional footprint, is that truth, that despair can give way to joy, and that you really can thrive as opposed to just surviving. And what you say is that it takes a belief in yourself and in the basic goodness of humanity. So in the couple of seconds that we have left, is there a way that you would like to leave the listener today? Is there a thought that you would like for them to hold on to today?
Yeah, I think what you just said, that people can come back from even destitution. I'm a firm believer in resilience. I don't want to pretend the life's a bowl of cherries and it's always going to be easy for people. Early disasters do leave some scars, but we can and shall overcome. One last point is that, and I should have made it earlier, nobody does it alone. And if you are open to reach, I call it the arm, if somebody extends a hand and an arm, and also you can be the person, well, two things. If somebody extending a arm, grasp it, and they will help you. And people do get help. And I'm not talking about psychiatrists, psychologists. I'm talking about people, librarians, or stories of teachers, people on the streets. It's remarkable. Remember what people do and say. But you too can be that helping hand to others and make a meaningful statement or more, some actual putting the arm, literal and figurative arm around their shoulder, and help them in a very destitute time, and can change their lives. And I don't know anyone who has ever done it all alone. They've had help because of, I'll use your words, the humanitarian, the benefits, what do you call it, the warmth of humanity or the strength of humanity. We shouldn't forget that in times when there's so much provocative statements being made in the airwaves, that human beings are capable of such benevolent, inspirational benevolence. And that's what I'm going on, as a kind of belief in humanity, like you are.
And again, just to close out, I'm going to close out with a sentence, with your closing sentence, in our emotional footprint, Ordinary People and Their Extraordinary Lives. You say, "We extraordinary people have an important choice to make."
Right, that's the point about we can be positive and use civility, cooperation, and community to contribute to our world and to our loved ones, or we can be negative.
Right.
And negative has all, you know, we're social animals, we're social beings, and we affect each other. And I hope people choose to be benevolent as opposed to negative to each other, because we're talking about imprinting. Not footprint. Imprint is better, because I mean it stays.
Yes.
And has ripple effect in society. So I hope people enjoy the book. There is a website called Our Emotional Footprint. There's actually a better Facebook page called Our Emotional Footprint, and that you can see my blogs, and also through my blog in Psychology Today magazine. I do a kind of weekly blog.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Levine, for your time, for your words, and certainly for bringing us the lives of these 10 ordinary, extraordinary people.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
And folks, thank you for listening to this edition of Mind Talk here on Mind Talk with Dr. Pamela Brewer. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to me at mindtalk@aol.com. And again, for more information about Mind Talk, you can go to mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And folks, remember always, if it is unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. Take care.